Good evening. This is Ozarks at Large for Friday night, March 20th, 2020. We begin tonight's show with news from the Arkansas Department of Health. In a press release this afternoon, the department said it is working closely with the Arkansas Department of Human Services and the Arkansas Healthcare Association to address cases of COVID-19 in three nursing homes across the state. Nursing homes affected include Apple Creek Nursing and Rehab in Centerton, as well as a facility in Pine Bluff and one in Little Rock. As of this afternoon, it was known of one patient who had tested positive for COVID-19 at the Centerton facility, Apple Creek Nursing and Rehab, and the Pine Bluff facility, the Villages of General Baptist West. 13 cases, including patients and staff, have tested positive at Briarwood Nursing Home and Rehab in Little Rock. ADH says in the press release, it's currently screening all other staff and residents for COVID-19 at Briarwood, and ADH staff are now on site at Briarwood. At a press briefing this afternoon, Dr. Nate Smith with the Arkansas Department of Health says Arkansas experienced its single largest one-day total of new confirmed cases. The total cases now standing at 96. That's after Thursday's briefing was at 62. Earlier today on our noon edition of Ozarks at Large, we had a conversation, as we do most Fridays, with Michael Tilley from Talk Business and Politics. He joined us from his home office in Fort Smith. We're going to hear much of that conversation now for our 7 o'clock edition. We'll pick up when I ask him about the Fort Smith Board of City Directors beginning to authorize that they could meet digitally, virtually. This is what Michael Tilley had to say about that.
Well, they can meet.
They can meet, right.
And I'll be surprised, Kyle, if they don't. They voted for to meet by electronic means, either by telephone or Skype or whatever they're going to use. And I think that's smart. They'll have some key city staff on the phone or on the video or whatever. But we just heard the governor yesterday essentially say, don't be gathering in groups of 10 or more. Mm-hmm. And he didn't say unless you're, running a city or whatever, he just said, don't gather. And we're seeing that's not just Arkansas. We're seeing that in states all over the country, in large cities all over the country. So, they've geared up to meet electronically. They already broadcast their meetings. So for the media, it really won't be that different. It'll be different in that we can't physically attend and ask them immediate follow-up questions on items, but that's going to be a minor issue compared to the overall reason we're doing this.
Fort Smith Convention Center, not surprisingly, closed.
Right. Yeah. I mean, they had so many events that just began to be canceled, and I'm surprised they closed early. I think the Hot Springs, a large convention center, Hot Springs closed, and shortly after, the Fort Smith Center closed. I've not heard, Kyle, if other centers have closed. I know today, on Thursday, the Arkansas Department of Parks and Tourism began closing welcome centers around the lobbies to welcome centers around the state, certain other heritage sites. So that has begun, but. Now, for example, this large Jehovah's Witness group that meets over a couple of weekends, they canceled. That's a huge economic loss to the city. They bring thousands of people in here, staying at hotels and eating at restaurants. The large regional dance contest that they bring in over a 2 to 3 day period, that's been postponed. I mean, that's just a limited number of things that have been postponed. So you're going to have a negative economic impact from that also.
The city of Fayetteville on Thursday morning announced curbside recycling pickups would be suspended. Department of Sanitation Fort Smith says recycling will be suspended as well there.
Yeah, and that's they've been looking to cut cost on that for a while, but now they're essentially trying to pull their staff back and saying only essential staff need to be on the job. And so to do that, they're going to have to cut back on the kind of stuff they gather. They're also cutting back on some of the tr- treeing brush that they collect. And so there's some other things that they're cutting back on. But the recycling program is going to be shut down through, I think, the end of April, from now to the end of April. So, you know, they've made provisions for people who want to continue to collect the recyclables, and that's all on their website. But yeah, that's another direct COVID-19 result.
Finally, one of four companies that's gearing up to produce and donate hand sanitizers in Fort Smith.
Yes, Pernod Ricard, which a lot of the old timers, including me, remember as the Hiram Walker plant. But, you know, they mix and bottle liquors and vodka and liqueurs. They're going to gear up and make hand sanitizer to produce and donate along with three other of their sister plants. Pernod Ricard, they're owned by, it's a Paris, France-based company. So they're going to gear up to do that. There'll be a gathering later Friday afternoon, I think. Congressman Steve Womack is going to be at the plant and talk to Melissa Hainsworth, who's the general manager, about what they're doing and how they've altered their production. But, you know, this is interesting. It's nice to see. I'm not saying this is a positive, but it's nice to see, you know, a local plant be able to gear up. They're keeping people employed. That's critical. It's critically important, but they're also keeping them employed in this, you know, what's now a national fight against this virus. So good for them. I do want to make sure that people don't get their vodka and their sanitizer mixed up, though.
No, don't do that. For either your hands or your insides, it would not be effective.
Right.
All right. You can read about all of this and much more at talkbusiness.net. My scheduling will be different a little bit next week. I'm in because we're observing some different hours here, but I think you and I will be able to connect and we'll still be able to talk next week.
Yeah. Just email me or text about some times that are available and
okay.
we'll get connected.
All right, Michael, please, you and your family and all your loved ones be well. We'll talk to you next week.
All right. Appreciate you.
This is Ozarks at Large. As restaurants close or see fewer patrons because of the COVID-19 pandemic, they may find themselves with an excess of food. One option to ensure the food doesn't go to waste is to donate the food to Northwest Arkansas Food Bank's Middle Mile Food Recovery Program. Yesterday, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda reached food sourcing manager Austin Harms by phone to learn more about one of the food bank's newer programs.
We are part of a pilot of food banks across the nation. We are actually working with those different food banks to kind of learn what are opportunities that we have that normally would not be something that a food bank works in. So when you think of a company, you think of a restaurant, think of a donor that's in the food space, they typically view the food bank as, okay, well, those are the guys that they can buy a truckload of food across the nation. They can take a big, massive donation when we want to work with major companies, but they don't want to spend their time getting their trucks to come pick up 20 to 50 pounds of food. And so what this middle mile program is really targeted towards is providing an opportunity to work with our donors and to work with new donors in this community to find outlets for donations of the smaller kind of format of food. So we can kind of provide them with just a wide variety of options that those companies can use. So they can use middle mile for, hey, I have 5 pounds of food, I have 100 pounds of food, but it's all in boxes that a volunteer can pick up, or they can also use that system to post their bigger posting as well. Hey, we had a big event, so now using that same system, I've got about 300 pounds of food. Okay, well, the food bank can use a small transit van to go get those type of items. It's really the focus of this pilot is to learn how are the different ways that we can plug in for providing for these companies an opportunity across all spectrums of donations, not to just think through, okay, well, I only need to work with my food bank when it's a big donation. That's not true. We want to really partner up and provide a resource for companies to get food back directly into their communities.
Who are you looking for locally who might be good for participating in this program, for signing up for it?
Our three areas that we see the most opportunity are, obviously, we know about our community that there is a lot of vendor offices that are in this area. They're going to have things like samples. They're going to be working with Walmart, Tyson, all of your big companies in this area. And so when they have those type of samples or extras that are coming out of their facilities and their offices, those would be a great contact point for us. That's something that's easy for most of our people to use. We would love to start working with them and get them connected. We are looking for caterers. One of the things that we are really trying to learn about with this program is we have the ability to pick up that food safely and get it directly back into one of our places that have an actual kitchen, and they might do a cooking meal and things like that. So there is, in for our food bank, we really haven't in the past done a lot with prepared foods simply because we don't have a kitchen in our facility. We don't have a great way to store that with our agencies. So this is going to be a good connection point where maybe a caterer has an extra abundance from one of their events. It's already packaged up. It's already got a little label on top of when they made it, what it is, things like that. And so our volunteers can go pick that up, put it in our coolers with our freezer packs and all that, and then get it directly to one of those agencies who is actually cooking meals. And then on the restaurant side of things, we are very much interested in learning what all kind of items they would have. I would say, obviously, for restaurants, most of them are going to be trying to cook things to order. So that's something that we're just learning. But we do know that there's going to be things that are getting close dated that we can still use on a food safety side of things that they typically wouldn't use in a restaurant space or a retail space. Kind of a wide spectrum of items and different types of people we want to work with. The other thing that's going to be a unique opportunity that we see with this program is things like a convenience store or a gas station who are going to have hot case meals. They're going to have little ready-made meals that at the end of the day, what do they do with those type of items? Normally people wouldn't think through, oh, well, at a gas station, they have food. But when you look at the places like Casey's and you look at places like Come and Go's in our community, they obviously have a lot of single serve type items that are great for these pantries because it gives them an opportunity to provide a meal quickly and easily alongside whatever they're already going to be given out to sustain that family for a little length of time.
So right now, with many restaurants and businesses closing or having, you know, shorter hours because of the pandemic, in theory, some of them might have, you know, food that's going to expire or food that they won't be able to, an excess of food, I guess, because they're having fewer patrons. Are they someone that could participate in this program?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been receiving those calls every single day over the last couple of days. So I'm doing one of two things. We can either connect those organizations into our own routes that are already going out into the community. The easiest way for those companies, though, is to just go sign up on mealconnect.org, and they can create their own account and just immediately put in what they know they're going to have. That way I can direct it, like I said, into the channel. Does it need to go with a volunteer? Does it need to go with a small transit van with us? Things like that. And I can kind of make it move to where it needs to go so that they get covered. But we do foresee that being a large opportunity right now, especially because I know all of these local companies are very tight on inventory that they keep. They are very good about keeping up with what they need to have in stock to prepare. When we have something that's just such a wide unknown, we want to make sure that they have that opportunity, that they don't feel like they have to throw it all away. And so, like I said, we so far have had a lot of response of people calling us and say, okay, I'm going to shut down for 2 weeks. What do you want me to do with this? Who can I get connected with to come pick it up? And so we're working hard to make sure that those connections get made and we find a home for that food that's going to go back into this community.
That was Austin Harms, food sourcing manager at the Northwest Arkansas Food Bank, speaking with Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda. In terms of regular operations, the food bank still needs volunteers to come to its warehouse to help pack food boxes that can be distributed to those in immediate need. If you have not traveled to an impacted area in the last 14 days, nor are you experiencing symptoms of illness, you can sign up at nwafoodbank.org. All right, speaking of restaurants, as officials move to halt the transmission of the coronavirus, many states are moving to close public spaces where community spread can occur. Restaurants and bars in our region are already starting to feel the impact of these new restrictions. Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth brings us this report.
Since the outbreak of COVID-19 in Arkansas last week, many restaurants and bars in the region have had to shift operations and enact new measures to help reduce the spread of the virus. Yesterday, Governor Asa Hutchinson directed all restaurants to suspend dine-in seating and to only allow pickup and to-go options. The governor made the announcement yesterday after confirmed positive cases of the coronavirus jumped to 62 in Arkansas.
It is clear to me that we do have increasing community spread. And whereas before it was primarily based upon travel, geography of where they have traveled to and back to Arkansas, but we did have one instance of community spread, and now there's more than just one.
And the governor says these new restrictions are paramount to limiting that spread. Earlier this week, Fayetteville Mayor Lionel Jordan had placed stricter regulations on restaurants and bars, reducing capacity to at least 50%, moving seating to up to 6 feet, and limiting groups to less than 10 people. But now, with dining options out of the picture, restaurants are having to readjust. Fayetteville-based coffee company Arcega's operates 5 cafes in the city. Now only 2 remain open, a drive-through location and its cafe on Church Avenue and Center Street, which had already cut back to to-go orders only by Tuesday. General Manager Sarah Cumston says the cafe is doing its part to remain open responsibly.
We're washing our hands all of the time. we're wiping down the counters about every 20 minutes, the door handles about the same interval. We have a great big door that we're just keeping open. We're asking customers, like somebody just came in and said, you know, there's no tables, but can we stand? And I was like, no, I'm really sorry, but we can't let you do that. And just like trying to respect a safe distance. And anytime you've, like, you know, we're sterilizing the register in between customers, but if you've touched the register, or especially if you've touched money, go ahead and wash your hands for the full 20 seconds, do a Clorox wipe, then go over to the toast. We're disinfecting the cutting boards more often, like during the shift.
She says the company did have to lay off some staff in order to cut operation costs, but also to allow some employees to draw unemployment income in the meantime.
We were able to keep enough staff to keep the doors open and allow the people who want to quarantine to have some income during that time, and also assure them that their job is here for them when they get back.
Lisa Perkayesta, who owns Kana Indian Grill in Fayetteville with her husband, says they are still open and trying to navigate the changes as they come.
We are a business that operates on very low margins and fortunately have a really tight and friendly staff, and we have a lot of camaraderie among ourselves. And so we talk about it every day, and we have seen a drop in a business, but not enough to make us go out of business.
Kana is offering drive-through and pickup services and also has an online option for customers to place their order. Perkayesta says she, like many other restaurant owners, is worried about revenue, but also food supply.
We know that at some point there will be impact in the supply chain, but for now we have all the ingredients we need to not change our menu, to just carry on.
In Bentonville, hospitality management group Rope Swing was one of the first to close its restaurants, Preacher's Son, Press Room, Louise, and 2 other spaces it operates in the 8th Street Market, which all ceased service on Monday. CEO Kurt Berman says because of the company's financial support from investors, its restaurants have more stability than many other locally owned businesses.
Our decision was based not only on closing the restaurants when we felt there was a right to do so, but also closing them early enough that we would ironically be able to help support the other locally owned small restaurants that were out there that were trying to stay open as long as possible. And some of them are still open at the moment, trying to do to-go or curbside delivery. We felt that by us staying open longer than was necessary is actually harming some of those other smaller businesses that were trying to stay open longer.
At the moment, Rope Swing is able to support their staff, including tipped workers, with regular paychecks. But Berman says that could change.
Our goal is to try and not have to lay anyone off. And obviously that would depend on how long the situation remains as it is. We really are hopeful that the situation will resolve itself. But obviously if that doesn't happen, then obviously we would need to make some decisions based on how we can maintain our team as long as possible without having to lay anybody off.
Berman says his restaurants are trying to support the community by donating food to the Northwest Arkansas Food Bank and by supporting other local bars and restaurants.
One thing I am sure about is that when we do open, it's going to be a very unusual situation that none of us, and by us, I mean the restaurant community at large in this region, have ever experienced. I think together the restaurants and bars in this region will work together when we're ready to reopen to ensure that we can all open.
But until then, service workers and owners are trying to brace for the worst. Back at Arcega's, Sarah Cumston pulls an espresso shot. She says the cafe is already having to cut back some hours.
Yesterday we made the decision to go from being open 7 to 6, Monday through Saturday, to being open 7 to 3. We're also taking our temperatures at clock in. And if anyone has a temperature of 100 or above, then they have to go home. They can't work that day.
Many owners say one way patrons can support their local businesses is to purchase gift cards so the restaurants can get some revenue now while business is slow. And Cumston says she's seen how many customers want to support local restaurants, bars, and cafes like hers.
People have been asking us, like, how we're feeling about being at work, and there's a kind of a community aspect of staying open in a time like this, and it's nice to be able to provide some normalcy and let people keep just a little part of their routine and, you know, give people a little smile and a little, like, everything's going to be okay, fellow citizen.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Daniel Carruth.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
This is Ozarks at Large. Several coronavirus testing sites have opened across the region this week. The latest is a Mercy Hospital coronavirus evaluation site in Rogers that opened today. We're going to have more about that on Monday's edition of Ozarks at Large. The site is set up as a drive-thru, but it is still reserved for patients who have a fever of at least 100.4 degrees and respiratory symptoms, including cough or shortness of breath, and either travel to a high-risk area or contact with a known patient. Anyone seeking a test has to call the evaluation site before arriving. That number, 479-717-7585. As more testing sites become available, more people are getting tested. Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek spoke with Laura Bell Phillips, who got tested this week. Bell Phillips says she's not a medical professional, but she wanted to share her experience.
Maybe let's start with a question that I think our listeners will be wondering about, and that's whether you've gotten the test results back yet.
No. I was tested on Tuesday evening, and they said it should be 3 to 4 days. And apparently, from what I understand, they're sending those to Quest Laboratory. I might be wrong, but that's what one of the nurses at the testing facility told me. Which is why the turnaround takes so long.
And which testing facility did you end up going to? And, you know, what was that whole experience like?
I went to the Washington Regional Testing Site, which is right across from the hospital. When you walk up, there are two obvious entrances. And one has two or three people in full protective gear. People might get kind of freaked out when you get out of your car and there's people in what looks like hazmat suits, but they have the hair bonnet and the mask and gloves and gowns and shoe protectors and goggles, and it is just to protect them, because we have got to protect our healthcare staff, because they're the ones that are, you know, literally on the front line of this and exposed to, you know, heaven knows how many patients a day. So don't be alarmed by that. But they took my information and asked me a few questions, and I had already done the screening through the Washington Regional Hotline. When I told them that, it went a little faster. And because of my chronic health conditions, I was immediately escorted to a door next door where there were a few, I think there were probably about six curtained off areas with tables and, you know, vital blood pressure cuffs, pulse ox. They had one of the super fancy thermometers that didn't need to touch me. I was given a pair of non-latex gloves to wear, just again to protect surfaces. And the only time I took those off was when they were checking my oxygen saturation on my finger, the little clip that goes on your finger, and they immediately wiped that down. And so they, you know, asked questions about my travel history. Sorry, my travel history and what kind of health problems I had and my symptoms and how fast they approached or how long I'd had them, how high my fever had been, and I met the criteria for testing. So they tested for COVID-19 and the regular flu, and those are both swabs that go up your nose, which are not super fun, but they go as quick as possible and, you know, are very cognizant that this is an extremely uncomfortable test.
Definitely.
And so I should get those results in 3 to 4 days. And I have never wished to just have the regular normal flu so much. But the staff was, you know, completely professional, very compassionate. But, you know, there was a sense of urgency and seriousness. There was, they weren't, you know, being hyperbolic about, you know, oh, you have to be careful. But, you know, we were stressed that go home and quarantine yourself until you get the test result. Try and limit contact with anybody else in your family. Do not leave the house. So I am in our back bedroom with Netflix. And if I do leave the room, I have a mask. I haven't really talked to my kids since Tuesday.
Oh, my.
So that's been a little hard. But I've also felt, you know, so awful that I'm just kind of here watching bad TV and trying to stay hydrated.
Feel free to go into as much detail as you feel comfortable with for this next question, but what made you go, I really think I need to be tested for coronavirus?
So Tuesday, I actually had an appointment at the oncology clinic. And so obviously I don't think I got it there because it takes so long for the symptoms to kick in after exposure. But I do want to stress to people that I wasn't out, you know, at a bar or a restaurant or something. I was at a doctor's appointment. That's the only reason I left the house. And so about 2 or 3 o'clock on Tuesday, I was like, I really don't feel good. And I felt, you know, hot and flushed. Checked my temperature. It was about like 100.6. It wasn't 101. It was still in that range where it was like, okay, that's kind of concerning. And I started getting a lot of chest pressure, shortness of breath, and cough. So I'm a breast cancer survivor, and I finished chemotherapy in February.
Okay.
And so it was soon enough after chemo that I felt like calling my oncologist was the right move. They immediately referred me to the hotline, which is 479-463-2055. And, you know, it maybe took 5-8 minutes. And again, the nurse was very kind and very patient in me asking questions. You know, they didn't throw a lot of medical jargon at you. It was just very simple, very plain questions. And based on my symptoms and my medical history, I was then directed to this testing site. And so my husband and I loaded up and went to the testing site, and we were in and out in maybe 30 minutes. There were a few people in line, and they were encouraging us to stay 3 to 4 feet apart. So when you get there, they immediately put a mask on you if you don't already have one. I was lucky because of last year's cancer diagnosis, we had a pretty big box of masks left over. So I went in a mask. But if you just walk up based on, you know, your screening phone call or orders from your primary care physician, they will put a mask on you and a pair of gloves. So there were, you know, like I said, maybe 3 of us standing 3 to 4 feet apart. And they were able to get, like I said, they have quite a few little areas sectioned off. So they were able to to get us in a pretty timely manner.
So it sounds like the breast cancer diagnosis and the treatment that followed do mean some potential immunodeficiency that is such a concern during this outbreak.
Right. I also have an autoimmune lung disease and rheumatoid arthritis. And so it's just a really fun bag of making me really immunocompromised. And obviously my story is going to be a little different because of my medical background, but I just wanted to kind of, and that's why I posted in the Yolidarity group online, I wanted to take some of the mystery out of the process, and that it is very simple to call this hotline and it might be nothing, you know, and if you don't meet the criteria, which they have to be strict with, they will refer you to urgent care or your primary care physician or, you know, somewhere else where you can get care, because sometimes those symptoms can be other things, but when they feel like they're all together enough that it warrants testing, they are doing the testing.
Did you get any guidance for what happens if you know, if the test does come back positive?
I mean, basically, you're quarantined for about 2 weeks is what they told me, just to make sure that you're not actively infectious. It's a good sign when your fever starts going down, but the pneumonia apparently can set in like 6 to 10 days after you start feeling sick. And so that, I guess, been part of the problem is people start feeling a little better and then go back out and can infect more people. So that's why it's so important to flatten that curve and, you know, do like California and New York City have done. Just stay home. If you can at all, please stay home, because people like me who are immunocompromised or have these chronic conditions are the ones that are, you know, most likely to get it. And it could be really, really bad for us. And I know that not everyone can stay home. And I'm very privileged that my partner and I are able to stay home and my kids are home from school. But I completely understand that not everyone is in that situation. But if you can, please, please, please don't go out.
Thank you so much, Laura, for letting us into your life a little bit and kind of what you've been through the last couple of days.
Well, I appreciate you asking and trying to, you know, get that demystification out there. I really appreciate it.
Laura Bell Phillips speaking with Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek about getting tested for the coronavirus. That Facebook group she mentioned called Yolidarity, we did a story on that earlier this week. You can find Antoinette Grajeda's story at ozarksatlarge.com. Buffalo National River is closing certain facilities until further notice due to the pandemic. Casey Brandstetter, branch chief of interpretation, says they're complying with guidance from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, as well as federal and state authorities.
Those closures that we currently have are for primarily buildings. So the Tyler Bend Visitor Center is now closed for public use, as is the Steel Creek Visitor Contact Station and the Buffalo Point Visitor Contact Station. Our headquarters building located in Harrison, Arkansas, is closed to the public as well.
Park staff working in the building and on the park are adhering to social distancing rules, she says. And group campsites and pavilion also closed.
Individual camping is still open for visitors to utilize. The river is still open for visitors to utilize, as are trails and open space areas in the park.
Visitors are encouraged to pack it in and pack it out, as trash pickup and park staffing will be limited. For more information, you can also call the park 870-439-2502. Fridays, we bring you a performance recorded in our studios, and you know what? This Friday's not going to be different. Late last year, Austin-based musician Taff Mashburn stopped by the Firman Garner Performance Studio, and he spoke with Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis about his unique styling, and he performed a few songs while he was here.
First song is going to be called Door Within a Door.
Okay.
You from the canopy in my cloud gray dove skin suit. Birds like us, we do not fly together. Our nights lit by the light of another moon. Sky so big it could swallow you. Oh,
That was great, man.
Thanks.
That was very beautiful. Well, welcome back to Fayetteville.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So this is what, the second time you played here?
Yeah, second time I played here. The first show was at the Backspace two or 3 years ago.
Last time you were here, you played solo with a guitar, just your voice. You're doing that again today.
Yeah.
Do you normally play solo, or do sometimes you play with a band?
I'd say it's more than half shows are solo. If I'm playing in Austin, there's a chance that I'll put some kind of ensemble together. I recently added the sound of a trumpet.
Ooh.
Or not trumpet, sorry, trombone.
Oh, right.
To a lot of my recordings that are forthcoming, and it's been such a joy to play with a horn player, and I've done a handful of shows where we have a full band, and that's always so much fun. But I decided some time ago that I like to challenge. So I've been playing, this is my fourth or fifth solo tour.
Oh, wow.
And it's about being compact on the road, but it's also about how much can I make this about my voice and nothing else.
But your voice is pretty unique. I mean, you sing in a higher register, and couple that with your fingerstyle guitar playing, it's not something I've seen very often. How did you develop that sound?
I have a very sweet friend who is a classical guitar playing person. And I had found myself living in a grain silo in Vermont in 2000, and I know, in
that
2016,
seems really unique.
And I had some time on my hands, and he was living in Los Angeles at the time, and I was like, we would just Skype and talk, and I mentioned that I was just like giving myself some exercises that I made up just to get better at guitar, and he's like, oh well. You know, why? I don't want to just give you some lessons. And I'm like, well, you live in LA and I'm in Vermont. He's like, well, we can Skype. And so we started doing these Skype guitar, classical guitar lessons. And he was teaching me basically as if I were a beginner student. And I learned a lot about a different way of playing. I mean, I stopped using a pick because I like the tone of my fingers. So that's part of the vector of the guitar playing, and then the voice is a long story that I guess starts with my mom forcing me to go to church. And along the way there's a stint where I was working in a sorority in undergrad at UT, and I worked at Tri Delta, and I was they're called house boys. I was a house boy. We would clean the kitchen and you know, the basic stuff. But one of the cooks he just would only listen to Nashville country. And as a young, angry DIY youth, I just thought that was unacceptable. And my way of tolerating it, but also kind of needling him, was to like satirize the singing style of the country artists. And I accidentally got a singing lesson out of it. Because, you know, you try to do the thing, you know. And before you know it, if you have the propensity to do a vibrato, you're doing it because they slather that stuff on like barbecue sauce.
Right, right.
And that was a waypoint along the way. And then I stopped writing rock music and started writing slower music to give my voice a chance to breathe.
Okay.
Yeah.
So your last release, Goodnight Plum, came out earlier this year. What off of that release are you particularly proud of?
Well, song-wise, I feel like the first track, it's called Rooms, is in some ways maybe an artistic milestone for me. The songwriting, all those things, just a lot of things just went right for one reason or another. And then the record itself was like an experiment that was, I think, in a lot of ways a success. The experiment was to perform a solo concert live in the studio.
Hmm.
I had about 30 friends come to the studio in Austin, and I played the songs either guitar voice or piano voice, and those became the basic tracks for further recording later. And if you haven't made records before, that's just not how you do it. So drums and bass and all that came after the fact. And I had just wanted to be like, I want the record to sound like, quote unquote, like live without it being advertised or marketed as a live record. I just wanted it to have that feeling. And so I'm really proud of the way that it feels that way. And I was shocked that Cosmic Dreamer wanted to put it out, but they did. And that has been a source of happiness for me.
How difficult was it to put that record together if you recorded, you know, in essence, the melody lines first and then the rhythm afterwards? How difficult was it to line everything up in post?
I practiced a lot. I performed, recorded it in a September. And every weekend the summer prior, so for 3 months, I played a show every weekend to practice them. And so my tempo was all right. I had to do a little bit of editing to make it playable for my collaborators, but those people are very used to my methods. So they're like, oh yeah, it's fine. And I didn't mind it sounding off or like the tempos dragging or pushing and pulling. Right. Like I love Dr. John's first record. Gree Gree Man is such a touchstone for that. And that thing is like, it's so trashy. It's so like, it's not a quote unquote professional record, but it is like, it's in the canon, you know?
Right.
So yeah, it wasn't that hard. Cause I knew that, you call the right people and it's not that hard.
Right. Well, that was your last album. You are working on a new one, presumably.
That's right. Yeah. I have a round of mixes that are in the pipeline to be mastered as we speak. And then I have 8 or 9 songs that are about halfway through with tracking. So you could say 2 albums worth of material.
Oh, wow. And what are your plans for releasing them? Do you have any kind of time frame in your head?
No, I don't have a time frame in my head. I would think maybe sometime next year would be a good...
Okay.
Seems to make sense for at least one record. But
all right.
I think so much of it also has to do with like who connects with it in the moment that you're showing it to people.
Right.
And I'm more open to that than I am like, it has to be September.
I gotcha.
Yeah.
So in the meantime, where can people find out more about your music, stay up to date with what you're doing?
So I'm on Spotify under Taft, T-A-F-T. I'm on Bandcamp, and I think that is bandcalledtaft.bandcamp.com or however the URL works. And then I promote really heavily through Instagram about shows and tours. If you search Taft, I'm usually the second one behind the sock company that took my name.
I didn't realize there was a sock company called Taft.
There is, and whoever looks this up will discover that too. But yeah, I promote a lot through that because it seems like a very direct line to people.
Yeah.
So I like that.
I dig it.
Yeah.
Well, Taft, this has been an absolute pleasure talking with
Thanks,
you.
Tim.
Would you mind playing one more song to close us
sure,
out?
Sure, yeah. This next song is called First Time.
Someone new. it's your first time watching the water die. Thousand yards stare in your eye. The waves light out and die. We watch the water dry. I changed my mind for you. Change my body for you. Change my mind for you. I'm
was Taft Mashburn performing in October in our Furman Garner Performance Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio. You can find his music on Spotify or Bandcamp, and you can connect with him on Facebook or Instagram. He sat down with Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis while he was in town. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Eureka Springs. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF, and 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Contributors to the show today included Antoinette Grajeda, Jacqueline Froelich, Zuzanna Sitek, Daniel Carruth, and Timothy Dennis. Timothy also mastered our show from his home. We will be back with you Sunday morning at 9 for Weekend Ozarks at Large. And of course, we'll have a brand new week of daily editions of Ozarks at Large beginning Monday at noon on 91.3 KUAF, also at KUAF.com. And also, you can listen to us for free as a podcast. We're available through Stitcher, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, and so many other services where you find podcasts. Again, it's absolutely free. A few more items that have crossed our desk since noon. Walton Arts Center extending its suspension of public performances now through May 9th. This includes the entirety of the Artisphere Festival and the national touring production of Fiddler on the Roof. Botanical Garden of the Ozarks this afternoon decided it is closed until further notice. And Northwest Arkansas Community College will have online classes through the duration of the spring semester. 2020 commencement ceremonies postponed with hope they'll be rescheduled at a later date. That is all the time we have for tonight. Come back to be with us Sunday morning at 9. I'm Kyle Kellums from the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. Have a great rest of your Friday night.